right at the top, the intellectuals, the politicians, and the mainstream media, there is considerable silence there actually on this topic. It's the folks in the middle, you know, trying to raise this as an issue and talk a lot, but you know, we're still far away from being that influential to actually go and, you know, affect a change.
The concept behind providing free and compulsory education to all children across India sounds maybe a tad idealistic, but noble perhaps on some level. And yet 7 years after the Right to Education Act has passed, it continues to come under heavy criticism among educators and school establishments, and even parents and general citizens alike, and its deadlines continue to get postponed. On today's episode of Drishti Talk, I'm joined by Hari Prasad as we try and break down what RTE is, why it doesn't work, what should happen next. Namaskar, I'm Chirag, and it is Wednesday, December 13th. Hari Prasad, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, Chirag. Yeah, I'm doing fine. Thank you for inviting me, and look forward to a good discussion.
To start with, let's talk a little bit about the Act itself, right? The Act was drafted in 2009 and eventually passed in 2010. The idea behind which was to provide free and compulsory education to all children between the ages of 6 and 14, which roughly translates to grade 1 to grade 8. It was looking at standardization of schools and teacher requirements, so things like facilities schools have to provide, certifications teachers have to go through. One of the hotly contested topics within the law was the allocation of a 25% quota, even for schools that weren't aided by the government, where a government school was not easily accessible and so on. The idea being that if there was a child from an economically weaker family, he would have a government quota even in a private school. Additionally, there was a provision for no detention. So any child between the age of 6 and 14 couldn't be held back even if he failed. Even at the outset, I mean, as we're talking about this law, we can already start to see quite a few problems. I'll start with the no detention one. To me, it seems pretty weird that someone would even think about this, because we've had multiple surveys and multiple studies that were done. There was one done a couple of years ago where it clearly showed that most kids in our schools were reading at half their levels. So someone from grade 6 was reading at a grade 3 level and things like that. There was a national achievement survey done in 2017, and honestly, it painted a very, very sad picture. And I'll post a link to this in our show notes. But as an example, children that passed out of grade 8, they were not able to pass 50% of the questions that a student would be able to do. Why would this have been done?
I mean, it's a very strange decision that they introduced. No detention, in RTE, right? The one thing I want to highlight is in 2014, I think it was, when they set up a committee to kind of review the impact of no detention. And it was about 5 years, and several batches of students had gone through that. That report starts right at the outset by saying there's no evidence of, no detention having harmful impact. And then the remainder of the report goes on to document a whole lot of available evidence about how no detention has proven to be false. I mean, we know that several state governments for decades now had a equivalent version of no detention, and feedback from them to this committee was that it doesn't really work well. And in the report actually concludes by suggesting that there should be some form of detention at least till grade 5 or 6, something like that. When they dug out all this evidence in 2014, what becomes apparent is that these data were actually available in 2009 as well, when they actually made the law. Now, one of the primary goals of RTE is to improve the quality of the education. So you would actually assume that they would do their homework, do some groundwork, and come up with facets of the law which actually facilitates improvement. Only thing I can think of, it seems to be some kind of social justice angle to this. Primary goal is to just ensure that the targeted segment of children just go through the classes. Just the sheer exposure to the school environment is going to place them at a better level. Of course, what didn't happen in framing of this law is the impact on other students, on the overall education system itself. And that's what is coming back to bite us now. The most natural outcome of no detention is that the quality of education will fall, because there's no pressure on the teachers to do a good job and ensure these kids actually qualify. And there's no pressure on the kids, on the other hand, to, you know, study hard and actually qualify for the next grade. I mean, you could have always had clauses which said if a particular kid doesn't make the mark, then we have this plan B to push him or her up, which is what I think they are now trying to introduce in 2017. But that's like a common sense solution, right? So you don't have to declare at the outset that no matter what you do, you're just going to sail through till, you know, grade 8. So, I mean, the effect of such a rule is well known, and that's what has actually happened. The unfortunate thing is about 8 batches of students have at least, you know, gotten out, you know, via this system. The impact of this on the country as a whole is, you know, we're going to pay a price for this drop in quality.
Absolutely. Part of the National Achievement Survey that was conducted, the number of students were able to answer 50% of the questions in their grade correct. And in class 3, it's 76% of them. And in class 8, it's 14. That's 1-4. So we're not talking, okay, there's a slight dip of a couple percentage points. I want to sort of go back to one of the points you made, which was about the intent, right? With the intention was perhaps, let's just get these kids through school. And that is shown in another area, which was one of the questions that was asked during a review of the initial drafting of the law was, what about pre-class 1? Because you already have a divide here, where there are kids who go through kindergarten and preschool. And then there are other kids who are not eligible, who are not able to go through that. But then they become eligible at, you know, at class 1 or at 8-6 directly to class 1, right? And so there's a divide between these schools. And what happens? Who's responsible for that? Because it's the government that's taking the step to say, we will now fund the child as of 8-6. But the government's not providing to raise them to that same level.
So it's a very important point you made, the fact that they made grade 1 as the entry level for RTE. I think there's an option there, but really grade 1 is where most schools admit. I think what happens is many of the students coming in under the 25% category could actually have skipped the pre-KG stages. So the moment they enter grade 1, there's already a significant gap between them and the other students. And then you bring in no detention on top of it, you know, there's no real measurement, and consequently, there's no real correction. So whether you're really helping the 25% catch up with the other students and become, you know, equally capable citizens at the end of it is really in doubt here, right? I mean, it's not serving the primary purpose.
Even if someone were to argue with us that, yeah, but you know, 8 years of no detention? Student gets into school at the age of 6. I won't know what he's doing until he turns 14. That's crazy. And even if I do, it's not centralized. The data isn't centralized. So the school might know. We were talking about incentivizing schools. I mean, you're not even incentivizing the students to do something. We can have multiple debates about whether our examination system is worth it, whether our examination system or these learning outcomes actually evaluate the student. And we should have those debates. But the fact that we didn't have to do that is what's boggling.
Absolutely. I mean, they'll have to answer this question, right? Okay, we prepare children, we want to throw them out into the open world 15 years later. Can they guarantee that each of these students will get into a non-competitive segment of society and somehow lead their life? I mean, almost every institution out there where kids are going to go and enroll is a competitive market. It's a competition out there. And, for such a, cruel and, society, cruel, I mean, to put it bluntly, are you going to prepare kids by not even testing them? I mean, is that the right way? You're letting them have a good time for 8 years. Where is he going to pick up the skill to study, crack exams, crack problems, compete with others, and, come out on top? That whole instinct is going to die.
So in the monsoon session in 2017, August 2017, this aspect of the law has been modified, right? So now you actually can be detained. But they've worked out some, a little bit of a compromise. So what they're allowing students to do now is that if they are not able to clear the examination and get through the next stage, they'll get a second pass at it, right? So they get a pass at trying to take that exam again rather than repeating the whole year.
I think there's also a slab there. I think till grade 5, you still can't get detained. And I think it's from 6 to 8 that this new law comes in. Right about the fact that they get a second chance. And I think there's also some responsibility on the teachers and, in that situation where they have to, train them additionally, take extra classes and ensure basically that they Before the RT era, I mean, in the system that we, I mean, all of us actually studied, we had something similar. I mean, kids would fail 10th or 12th exams, and there's always this concept of a supplementary exam for which you prepared and came back after a few months and attempted and got through. And that system was working, right? So they had these, instruments, at their disposal when they framed the law.
Yeah, it wasn't even that they had to come up with something new. There was a parallel system existing. I mean, it goes out even in universities, right? We have what they call the ATKT and stuff like.
And just one point on this, there's one exception that the committee took in 2014 saying there's not a lot of, material available which shows the impact of no detention or detention. That's actually not true at all. Even some cursory research that I have done has thrown up a huge body of work, especially in North America. I think some people have obtained PhDs and done a lot of research on that as well. There's tons of data which shows, there may be certain societies where no detention works well. Certainly, it's not a universal policy. So, maybe we just didn't do enough work to get hold of that and study them, but it's definitely not true.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, I mean, there is naturally a financial implication to that, right? So, which I, just to quantify it in a way to say, if the government's going to pay for, for someone to go through 8 years of schooling, this the fact that there will be detention implies that they might have to do 9 or 10 years. So there is an implication. But, this is, at the end of the day, this is about, yes, the country's future as a whole, but about a child's future. And so to me, I mean, it's, yes, I understand that there's a question of taxpayer money, but if you're going to spend it on someone's education, then let's do it right the first time. Because for me, otherwise, the 8 years go down the drain, which is nuts, right? It's as you correctly put it, I mean, it's the price that you would have to pay for these eight batches of kids that have gone through this without detention, or 14% of the kids or not even able to clear, or just about able to clear 50% of what they should know in a certain grade. I mean, this has a huge financial implication as well.
No, it has huge financial implication given where we are now. On the other hand, if the makers of RTE were really confident about the theory which they put into making this law, then they would have had to assume that only a very small percentage of these kids who come in via the reservation are going to actually get detained. And in that case, the burden wouldn't have to be so much at all. But on the other hand, already knew that, for some reason, a majority of these kids are going to suffer due to no detention, then it means there's fundamentally something wrong with the, with their approach itself. So, on one hand, they wanted to push some law, and it looks like, they themselves were not confident about the shape that it'll actually take.
Just going to touch quickly on it, but the teacher certification, right? Here again, there is the same kind of discrepancy that comes through, which is they were supposedly confident when they drafted the law that it would take them 3 years to get all the teachers certified according to a new standard. And yet here we are 7 and touching 8 years later, where we have just gotten another extension of a year for the certification. So we're failing even here. I mean, we still do not have our teachers certified, which means again, back to the same story, which is 8 batches of kids have gone through with uncertified teachers.
Absolutely. And fundamentally making an assumption that you can get over a problem by imposing a restriction, I think is flawed, especially if it is physically impossible. The reason I say is, there was one very interesting tweet immediately after the amendment that was brought in. And I have not done the mathematics behind it. But apparently, if those teachers who have not started the program at all, if they have not made a beginning as of the date of the amendment, then they will never be able to complete the program, with the new deadline as well. So it's bound to fail. So you brought in an amendment and gave some 2019 deadline, knowing very well that the target segment of teachers for whom you made that, facilitated and brought in that amendment actually can't get through, because of a physical limitation. I mean, it's a 3-year program or something, if I recall correctly, and the extension is not that much. So very little thinking has gone behind each aspect of RTE, I would say.
Initially, if it was going to take 3 years to get all the teachers certified, and that didn't happen, it's now more than double that time because it's now touching 8 years. And the problem is that you are not going to disqualify them, are you? Because we have an education problem. We need the teachers. So you're saying it's going to be, okay, let's extend it that much further and further. And then this becomes an endless problem.
I mean, I think there's another reason over here, right? Out of all the sensitive aspects of a school. If you impose a hard restriction and some punitive measures on teachers, I think schools who are compliant with RTE are going to see some dramatic changes, erosion of the teachers. They just walking away across to the the minority schools and those schools who don't have to comply with RTE and all. And probably they expected that backlash. Otherwise, if you look at every other section of RTE, punitive measures are just seamlessly built in. You don't comply with RTE, the school gets a closure notice. You screen a student, there's a 50,000 fine for the first time. So they probably anticipated it, but also calculated the repercussions of putting some punitive measures there. And when you don't do that, these deadlines are just artificial deadlines, right?
Yeah, and again, the same story again with the financial implications of all of this stuff. Look at that school. Even though they were a small percentage, but look at those schools that complied in the first 3 years, went through and put in the money and so on. Who's going to pay for that difference, right? It's going to be the kids, right? The parents, because they have to rationalize that cost. Of course, I'm talking in a hypothetical, but you've got a school on one side of the street where everybody's compliant and they've gone through all the certification, everything. And then you've got a school directly across the street where, let's say, 10% of the teachers are certified. And they're both operating as compliant because the deadline just keeps getting extended. So you're actually indirectly, setting yourself up, as you said, for failure, because everybody thinks, you're not going to do anything to the teachers. This will just keep going on.
It's a tough problem to handle, actually. Out of all the issues, I think the teacher qualification compliance is a tricky one, because here we need to bring in the minority schools angle, right? So there's an opportunity out there for teachers to get away from all this, because perhaps some of these minority schools have their own internal training program or certification program. And, I know that there are some basic qualifications that are required, and I'm not talking about that. But in terms of these additional certifications that are required, if you have a bunch of schools, if you have a segment where that is not required, and you're being pressurized, there's a very good chance that many of these people will hop.
Let's get into that, right? Because I think this is one of the biggest angles when we're talking about RTE anyway. So
yeah, so just one point I wanted to make on all these intricacies or the sections of RTE that we just touched. If you just get back a little bit and look at a higher level, it's a very strange law, RTE, in terms of what it actually does versus what it actually should do. So when RTE came in, the goal was clear. Too many out-of-school kids who need to be brought into the system, educated, and they start contributing. That's goal number one, and there's no dispute about it. So then the government also decided that the existing government infrastructure is not sufficient. So they explicitly coded it via the 93rd Amendment and the actual RTE Act, that private schools also will come in. I've written a little bit about it, where there was a huge debate during the creation of Article 21A itself about whether private schools should be kept out. Whatever it is, finally they decided private schools, also need to be brought in. Government infrastructure is not enough. But we also know at that point in time, when RTE came in, right, private schools have a certain capacity, simplified, they can handle 1,000 kids, let's say. But now the government comes in and says, I have got this list of 250 additional kids who you need to absorb. So basically the capacity of the private schools has to go up. Now, if you apply the basic rules of economy, it would say any segment, any sector, you want it to grow, you need to incentivize it. You need to facilitate growth. So, software industry, for example, I think we are in touch with that, okay? There are all these SEZs and zones and tax breaks and whatnot. And we see that the sector has grown. Similarly in agriculture, different kind of a problem, but there's support in terms of there's waivers and there are other schemes, easy loans and so on, basically because you want that sector to grow. So if you want the private school sector to grow, you would have had to incentivize it, right? You brought in RTE at the same time and all it's got is, restrictions, rules, punitive measures, threats. It's the exact opposite of what you want. If you require the private sector to actually grow and contribute to the goal that the government talks about.
Yeah, and let me add to that a little bit as well. Forget incentivizing. It's actually gone, five steps in reverse. Because not only was the law set up and this quota set up and so on, But the determination of the reimbursement of this quota is based on government schools and not the private schools' costs. So you actually went backwards, because not only did you not incentivize it, but you actually are now making the remaining 75% of those children pay for those 25% in addition to the taxpayer money, right? Because as an example, I mean, I was looking up figures. There's this little bit of a protest happened, for example, in Maharashtra, where one of the complaints that they have is that they're not getting reimbursed. Same thing's going on in Karnataka right now as well. And the average estimate of the reimbursement is 14,000 rupees per kid for the year. Yes, sure, in a government school, that might be the cost. But we all know that's not the cost of getting a kid through primary school, like for the school itself. I mean, it's a private school, right? They will have, they look at a P&L, right? They are trying to make sure that they don't lose money. And so who's going to pay that difference, right? And it's getting distributed across the remaining 750.
I mean, there are multiple layers of problems there, right? First of all, the way they calculate it, they normalize it over the entire district itself is absurd, making a blanket assumption that every single private school in that district actually bear the same expense. Problem number two. And the problem number three is the biggest problem. You know, you do all these calculations and all that and yet don't pay. And now to cap it all, the cherry, so to say, is this trend with the fee regulation acts coming up in all these states. So, you know, okay, we are not going to pay you. We know we are suffering, but then, hey, you might go and take that money from the other 75%. So we're going to ensure you can't do that. And it's ridiculous, actually.
It's getting out of hand. And we're not even touching on the learning outcomes and the effect it's having on the education of the kids. But we're talking about the fact that this indirectly leads to bigger problems for the schools. Because again, this is just one aspect. This is just the fact that there's a quota for the kids in these schools. But let's not forget that there are severe facility and other restrictions for the schools as well. There are teacher-pupil ratios that they have to maintain, facility sizes they have to maintain.
Yeah, playgrounds. I think some states, for example, have rules even on the minimum number of books that you need to have in your library, size of the playground, and whatnot. I mean, if you're going to be so strict about how a school should operate, again, they are normalizing, right? This is like for the entire state, every single school, irrespective of whether it's in the city center or on the top of a hill, have got to comply with each and every one of these restrictions. It's just not going to work out. I mean, the schools will definitely start shutting down, and we are already seeing that.
Yeah, and we're talking, and what we've been discussing just now is schools shutting down because they've made it extremely difficult. But that doesn't even count. Then there's the next step of schools that are getting shut down, which are getting shut down because they're not complying, because there is no clear estimate on how many schools have been shut down. I mean, a lot of people have thrown a lot of numbers around. There was a piece of news that came out a couple of months ago that, you know, some 800 schools in Punjab were served closure notices. There was a significantly larger number of closure notices served in Maharashtra. This data came from an agency called the National Independent Schools Alliance. Some 7,000 schools in Maharashtra last year reported getting closure notices, right? And let's assume that these numbers might be exaggerated. Even if that's the case, the fact that hundreds of schools are getting closure notices, the number of schools are going down drastically year on year.
Absolutely. So 2 points here, right? First of all, I think there are many numbers that are coming out of official sources. So I have at least personally seen some documents from the Delhi government and some from Punjab. You know, there was a statement made on the floor of Lok Sabha, Smriti Irani, when she was MHRD. She actually confirmed that there are school closures happening because of non-compliance of RTE. So, you know, once that is in place, I think this whole talk about exaggeration and more number, I mean, so what if there's some problem with the actual statistics? The fact is many, many schools, hundreds and hundreds of schools are closing down. The second point I want to make here is we can only measure either with error or accurately the number of schools that are closing down. What we cannot measure is the effect of these regulations and restrictions in discouraging new schools from starting, right? And I think that's the bigger impact, right? I mean, our population is growing. We've brought this new reservation policy in because of which suddenly you have an influx of students who have the opportunity to study. Then you made private education, private schools a part of it. And you're so thoroughly discouraging new schools from coming up. How are we going to measure that cost? So that, I think, is the bigger impact of what RTE is doing.
There was a study, an article that came out a few months ago, implying that the enrollment in government schools in Uttar Pradesh is going down, but enrollment in private schools is going up. You're actually seeing an outflow from public education schools because they're either getting shut down, they're not meeting requirements. And then there is the whole minority school angle. We have an article in our constitution that outright says any minority has every right guaranteed to them by the constitution to pursue,
establish and administer educational institutions of their choice.
Correct. That's something that can be debated by itself another
day. Exactly.
And when RT came about, with all of these restrictions and different qualifications and everything that we've been discussing, one of the first debates that came about almost instantly is, what you've done is in conflict with this provision. And therefore, you can't impose these, whatever these conditions are, whether it's on teachers, whether it's on facilities, whether it's on the quota, right? And so now you've got this brilliant divide where you have schools that are shutting down and restrictions that are being imposed and all of the harmful effects, but only applying to one kind of school and not applied anywhere else.
Absolutely.
And this tussle has been going on since RT was implemented. But what's worse about this to me is multiple court judgments that are conflicting with each other and how they should interpret this. Now, I'll just do an overview, but you had the Supreme Court coming out and saying in 2014 that minority schools will be kept out because of this provision in the Constitution. And the quota requirement for the economically weaker sections cannot apply to them. In 2016, a Kerala High Court came out and said, okay, all that other stuff is fine, but this no detention policy, let's have it across every school, whether or not they're in RTE or not. And in between, court came out and said, no, we got to apply it, across everybody. And in 2017, so earlier this year, Karnataka High Court stayed that order, saying that, okay, as of right now, minority schools are not obligated, right? So even the courts have not put their foot down in terms of saying, okay, this is how we're going to take it and let's move on this way and then deal with it.
No, that'll happen, actually. I agree with what you're saying in terms of what's actually happening, but the end result is pretty well known. So first of all, this whole big divide, right, well, in terms of applicability is not at all an accident or a side effect. It was absolutely crafted to be this way. It was by design. So I've written a number of articles on this, and I have no doubt left that this was always intended to be like this. First thing. The second thing is education. It's a concurrent subject for the Constitution. It's there on the state government's table as well as the central government's table. The way the concurrent subjects work, if there is a overarching law made by the center, which is not really in direct conflict with anything particular to a state, then whenever there is a mismatch between the central law and the state law, the central law takes precedence. Keeping that in mind, you should one should review RTE. The intention was always to introduce the 25% reserve to help the kids, but when the law came in, there were probably like 30 odd sections out there covering every single aspect of primary education. The effect of that is almost every state government law that existed at that point in time gets obliterated, right? So we are in this transition phase, in my opinion, where some of these state governments are trying to fight out some of these court battles by quoting their respective state laws. But as the cases come up, and eventually if it goes against the minority institutions, it'll definitely get to the SE. And then there's only one way of interpreting things. I mean, RTE is the law that is supposed to take effect. Does RTE cover it or not? Answer is yes for most of the topics. And then once the answer is yes, then what's stated in the RTE has to take a precedence. Sure, we'll get through these few years of some of these court battles in the state high courts. But I think the final decision in the Supreme Court, we already know, assuming RTE stays the way it is.
Yeah, and I think, at least in terms of the opinion the Supreme Court has given, although it dates back now to 2014, is that the Supreme Court interprets it as, no, they are exempt.
Yeah, and a very interesting interpretation, right? So the genesis of 2014 judgment is in the 2012 Rajasthan Unaided Schools judgment. So there, the court again quoted some of these severability principles and said, hey, we know RTE consists of these 30-odd sections covering various aspects, but we feel that those sections are not severable. We can't break it down into chunks and segregate them and say, hey, 10 of these are easily applicable to minority schools and the remaining only to majority schools and so on. Therefore, there's only one way we can treat it, which is to exempt minority schools from RTE. And then the 2014 judgment just added a little bit to it. It qualified it. 2012 said RTE will be applicable to aided private, minority schools. And then the 2014 Pramathi judgment said nothing doing. From an Article 30 point of view, there is really no distinction between an aided and unaided institution. So we agree with the severability analysis done by the 2012 judgment. So they got the complete exemption. Now, I think the whole crux of the matter is in this section of the discussion, right? The Article 30 and exemption. In my opinion, you know, to borrow R.C. Majumdar's word, I actually consider RTE as a lawless law. You know, given this unfair applicability, it's not even a proper law, right? The entire discussion that we had about the various sections of RTE and, you know, how they are good or bad, I mean, it's all fine. But then we are talking about something that doesn't qualify to be a proper law, in my opinion. The second part of the discussion that we are having, I think that is the real problem with RTE that we need to solve first. And then, of course, there are implementation issues. If there are issues about which sections need to be crafted, which way the real education experts can step in there. And then, you know, we have these experts from the other segment also coming in, you know, it becomes applicable to them. We share the problems, you know, find better solutions. But then now it's a problem for one segment of the society only.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, yes, we had to discuss some of the specifics of the law. But when it comes to any law for that matter, and I think this is something that I've had multiple discussions over lots of other laws as well with different people, is that we have to look at laws from an equality perspective, right? It has to apply to all citizens as it is. Sure, when we look at things like economically weaker sections, and of course, we've got the issue of reservations and other things in the country as a whole, and again, each of them deserve perhaps their own debate. But when we're implementing newer laws or when we're evaluating a law, we look at it from that perspective to say, okay, let's apply this law to everybody. And then let's see if there needs to be an exception. Fundamental flaw with RTE is that it applies just to one section of the population. Aggressively, not only is there a deviation of teachers out of the schools, but there's deviation of the students out of the schools, the parents preferring to do this.
So we've basically nationalized one segment of private schools. I mean, imagine, right, when we nationalize banks, if we declared that, you know, we're going to nationalize all those banks which have been started by, you know, people belonging to one particular religion. I mean, how ridiculous would that have appeared? The situation is the same here. 99% of the schools which would qualify for RTE are secular schools. They teach, you know, science, maths, languages, and things that lay the foundation for us to get higher education to make a living. So that being the case, exempting certain schools just because, you know, the founders belong to a particular religion and then applying it to other schools just because they're from, you know, the Hindu religion is completely inexplicable, right? It's a weird way of applying law.
You know, we're talking about the implication. Someone who's not an educator would see why this was an issue, right? For sake of giving somebody a benefit of doubt to say, oh, he couldn't have envisaged this, right? Like, just let's assume that for a second. It's been 8 years now. Ample data to correlate the fact that there is an issue. Why is nobody going back and saying, wow, there are some big flaws here? In the last parliamentary session, a member of parliament by the name of Mahesh Giri put in a private member bill saying, let's just legislate and get all the schools to follow the law. Right, the law should apply to everybody. Forget the statistics of the fact that, you know, it's not even, I think there's a, it's in single digits, the percentage of private member bills that actually get debated, discussed to the point where actually something might come out of it. But this is a private member. It isn't even, you know, an education committee's bill. It isn't the HRD ministry's evaluation or anything. This is not to take away from the Mahesh Giri. It's not even something that seems mainstream enough.
Yeah, we don't even know if it's officially sanctioned by the ruling party, first of all. I think we already know what's going to happen to the bill because there's a little bit of a misunderstanding there. It was actually not introduced in 2017 in the monsoon session. It was actually introduced in 2016 itself. We just got to know it because of social media and tweets by Mahesh Giri himself. So it's already gone through 3-4 parliament sessions. It's not probably not going to come up at all. But one interesting thing is people on the you know, ruling party side are also starting to recognize this. I mean, we can see it as an indicator of that. And there was another MP from the ruling party who has introduced amendment, suggested is an amendment to Article 30 itself. Make the rights equally available to all communities. Yeah, so that kind of work has happened, but it's not going to bear any fruit. That's the unfortunate part of it.
Something like this, considering we are 8 years into this law.
8 years, I mean, it's true that RTE is here since 8 years, but the real hope was from 2014 onwards, you know, for obvious reasons. You know, RTE is actually a manifestation of Article 15.5 brought in by the 93rd Amendment, which happened in 2005. And the fact is, the exemption given to minorities under that clause, right, was vehemently opposed by BJP. They not only debated against it, they voted against it. It's okay to assume that 2014 onwards, they would do something about it. And yet, when you have the mandate of the people, forget actually maneuvering this act in both houses of the parliament and getting it through. There's not even proper discussion. There's not even an initiation into discussion, right? There could be a fear that this is an anti-minority move. I mean, that can be taken care of by open and frank discussion, saying all we want to do is make it equally applicable to everybody. So the only thing we can think of is, deliberately discussion on this is being avoided. For what reason? I don't know. We may need another session to discuss that. Problems within the RTE Act itself, the excuse being given is this new education policy, which is in the works forever. And, you know, committee after committee and, there's a new committee that's going to come up now. And apparently early next year, we'll have the draft. So if you say, oh, what about the final shape of no detention? What about fees? What about learning outcomes? MHRD can say, hey, can you just wait for NEP? But on this aspect, this silence is totally unacceptable.
And we are talking today about something in the future. And mind you, that's going to be a draft. As of today, we don't even know if this is going to address some problems, not address it. We don't know what Smriti Irani, when she was HRD minister, had given a very detailed account about the different initiatives that they have been testing in certain public schools in certain states, about student databases and teacher certification databases. But 2 years hence, we are still talking about the draft of the national education policy. So for me, this is okay, cool. When it comes out, I'm absolutely going to do a podcast and I'm absolutely going to debate it and all of that. But as of now, we're talking a couple years out. Policy like an education policy, which, as we have just discussed, is on a concurrent list and therefore requires public opinion, but also requires state input and all of this stuff.
I mean, we should remember finally that this is actually the NEP is the output, is going to be the output of a committee. It's not the output of parliament, just a recommendation. And the whole process of accepting either whole of it or parts of it and making it into a bill and then getting it passed through both houses of parliament, notifying it, state governments making rules, and then, you got to time it with the beginning of an academic year. I mean, even if things go at full pace, I think they're talking several years away.
And again, as we just discussed, we don't know what its implications yet will be on RTE.
Yeah, I mean, the other puzzle here, right? We had the TSR Subramaniam Committee report out 2016 itself. The government has not offered any clear explanation on why that has been junked. I mean, some really vague statements have been given by the current minister, saying there was opposition to some sections of the report. I mean, if that's the case, those sections of the report could have been dropped, right? And the general measure, which was acceptable to everybody, could have been implemented. We lost 2 years without even a proper explanation on why we lost 2 years.
So we've kind of touched on this a little bit, but let me just get your thoughts on, what's next. We know that one of the primary issues is the quality of the law. While there may be some initial debate about the fact that at least some people identify this as a problem, what's next? Because one of the issues that I see as well is that in a lot of discussions that are happening about RT, and they're happening at a citizen level, right? Like people like you and me who identify that there's an issue and still don't have a concrete solution. Because obviously, and at the end of the day, it's a law and the law has to go through parliament and debate and discussion.
I mean, what's next? It would be more of a wish list from my side rather than a concrete plan, I would say, because I don't know if any of this would get done. But I think there are at least two or three main things that definitely needs to happen. RTE in its current avatar, current shape has to go. Absolutely has to go. It's doing more damage as we now have more and more data. Prior to RTE, it was primarily with the states. So they have a ton of experience on how to run these educational institutions. So in the interim, it's not going to be that difficult for the state governments to actually, formulate a policy. Secondly, the anomalies with Article 30 and the creation of bodies like the National Commission for Minority Educational Institutions, NCMEI. That's like a central body which has complete authority on all matters related to minority institutions. So it's basically the executing, instrument for Article 30. That's the execution wing of Article 30. Very strangely, only minorities can run it. Only minorities can be on that body. Even though the schools and colleges and other institutions they run has, probably in almost all cases, more non-minority students, more non-minority staff, more non-minority teachers. If there is an equivalent majority institution, it has to go through the grind of tons of rules and regulations at the state government and central government level. If it's an equivalent minority institution, it just goes to NCMIE and gets all its issues sorted. So there's some blatant discrimination there as well, in my opinion. That goes with the Article 30 package, you know, if you can call it that. Make it equally applicable for all. And then we are left with only the problem of how to make rules for, you know, running these institutions correctly, right? And then everybody can contribute to it. The third thing is, yeah, I mean, we need to get the right set of education experts and come up with maybe the, you know, version 2 of RTE. I mean, there's nothing wrong as long as it's a proper law, it's applicable to all. Sure, there are like really good experts out there who can contribute, which in my opinion, you know, has to incentivize the education sector more, but also put a sufficient number of checks and balances. We've done that with various other industries and segments, right? So I'm sure we can do the same with the education sector as well.
And there has been some emphasis on this, right, in terms of learning outcomes, and there were some amendments made to RTE. For me, this is where the confusion is, right? You see a little step here, a little step there, which implies that, yeah, we understand that education is an issue and you know, we're adjusting the preparation of learning outcomes. Again, whatever be the reason why they were not happy with a committee, we've constituted a new committee, which happened a few months ago for drafting the NEP, and they gave them, I think, a six-month deadline, because the first draft is expected now. And so there are these little a step here and a step there. And yet somehow it's, as you correctly said, somehow this topic as a whole, it just gets avoided. Well, just let's not talk about it.
Oh, absolutely. On the real critical issue, there is absolute silence. I think there is complicit, you know, acceptance from both sides of the, you know, political spectrum that needs to go. I mean, that's just a wish again. In terms of this tinkering, two things at least stand out, right? Referring to your point about learning outcomes, for example. One is, it's almost always reactive. You know, they see a problem, the problem is going out of hand. Hey, we've got no option but to try and do something about it. The second part here is, even when we decide to do something about it, in spite of previous known failures, we will still refuse to base it on empirical evidence, base it on facts, base it on data. We're just going to consult few quote-unquote experts. I actually think there's the same set of experts roaming around in all the ministries and giving opinions in one form or another. So learning outcomes, I mean, I have been thinking about this, right? It's a very strange approach they have taken. The premise of the state has been that people who are coming in through the reservations, who are coming in through support, to be treated a little differently, so they can't be held to the same standards. So you have either grace marks or reservations, or, you know, and under a policy which seems to recognize that they need additional support because of the historical background. I mean, it probably takes several generations for them to catch up. That's a theory. Okay, fine. Let's look at how it works. But then you have this class 1 to class 8 where folks from the kids from the same segment of society are being pushed in, and yet in learning outcomes, there's absolutely no difference between how you'll measure the 25% versus the 75%. So what really happened to your theory then? You know, how come it needed when they've gone through 15 years of schooling and college? I think the amount of thinking that's being put into making these policies itself, you know, it's very deficient. And they're not looking at the available data. They're not looking at results that they've achieved. I mean, we are 7 decades now, right? India is 70 years old. We have tons of data on how we have fared.
No, you were talking about like the states having run institutions and therefore having this, so has the center, right? I mean, the center has and commands a number of national universities. Smriti Irani, who was very clearly saying that, especially, and I have to recall the exact states, but I know she mentioned Jharkhand, I think, and they were running a lot of these trial programs about new coursework and look and measuring, you know, where the student was compared to everybody else in a slightly non-traditional way to be able to assess, you know, learning outcomes, you know, it's a bit of a buzzword, but try and assess a student not just on subjects alone, but also on extracurriculars and other activities and try to build a wholesome course program, right? How much time are we going to wait until all of this stuff gets goes through the system and gets bigger. We already have the inputs, right? And it's not a case of where there is an issue implementing things at a state level anymore, because we've got, you know, there are big states that are talking well with the center and working well with the center. There's just so much potential. And again, we come back to the same thing, which is it almost feels like, you know, this is just an area that they want to avoid. This is not to say that everything has to be a priority on a certain day, right? We also understand that all of these things, that there's a little bit of a compromise that has to happen. But education is such a key area.
It is the number one ministry, right? No doubt. It's the number one segment. It's the most critical segment for any society, for any country. I mean, we wouldn't relax for 1 minute about our country's defense, right? No matter what the situation is. So it's the same here. Education is like the...
Yeah, it's a building block of generations to come as well.
One point I would like to add here, I mean, just because we're talking about these new, you know, repair work being done and, you know, new laws being attempted, again, one striking feature of lawmaking you would see is there's, because of the lack of use of data and empirical evidence, they never qualify the problem correctly. So even with RTE, for example, if you look at the numbers from the pre-RTE era, the enrollment rates were in the high 80s in terms of percentages and consistently growing. Maybe a little slow, you know, to our dislike, but they were growing. So what was the real problem we were trying to solve by bringing in this 25% slab? And similarly with learning outcomes, right? They were at least not as bad as they are now. I mean, there's like a steep decline prior to RTE. There was like a slow increase or a steady increase. The non-reliance on such data means you will never set proper goals for what these new rules should apply. I mean, ideally, you would have said, hey, learning outcome shows a 50% success rate right now. I'm going to bring in some new rules and, you know, 8 or 10 years later, I need to be looking at 70%. That's the most common sense approach of making laws. I have enrollment rates in 85 to 90% range. I need to see it go up to 98 or 99 in 10 years. There's not a single slab that's established like this for any of our laws, especially for RTE.
We can't quantify it because there nothing was quantified to begin with.
We do have some reports now. I mean, the ASR reports and the other report that you just referred to. The only thing they are establishing is that RTE is an anti-pattern, not like we are saying, right? Every single aspect is actually aggravating the problem. So at least that much we are pretty sure.
And then you have all these disparities that exist because of it. So there is no standardization of education. You cannot expect to get a certain level of education in your schools because some schools apply, some schools it doesn't apply, some schools have the facilities. Some schools don't. We're supposed to standardize it and there's supposed to be a law to do that, but it doesn't apply to everybody.
You made a point about these alerts and the news that you follow, right? So, you know, I'll give you one small hint here. You subscribe to a few RTE and related alerts and then check what percentage of them talking about some court case or some fight or battle. The point is, if somebody is genuinely interested in education as a segment and, you know, is hoping he can start a school or a college, and he is definitely going to decide he will not enter it. That's the biggest problem. And then on top of it, you bring in this other aspect saying all these are applicable only for, you know, the majority, not for the minority. You know, you're clearly putting competitive restrictions on one segment of the society, and you're actively discouraging them from opening schools, and the real need of the nation is for more and more schools to be open, more and more quality schools to be open. It's simply baffling how, you know, such an approach has been taken and such an approach has been allowed to continue.
I know in my interactions with numerous people over the last few years, the people are enlisting themselves in minority schools because that's the only way they can open them, right? Because they don't have to go through the restrictions and the bureaucracy and the red tape and everything else. Because you're just exempt.
Yeah, we can always talk about, debate about the rate at which this is happening and, you know, whether it's happening everywhere or not. I mean, all that we can discuss. So the fact of the matter is, you know, this is based on sound, you know, competitive market theory. In a non-zero-sum game, if you're going to place restrictions on one of the players, the whole equation is going to shift towards the other player. And that's exactly what is happening here.
Hari Prasad, thank you so much for speaking to us and sharing your thoughts. I think, as you said, you know, we've raised some big issues and then there are other extended issues in the field of education, which definitely deserve their own discussions and so on. So hopefully we'll keep doing that. If you could share with us your Twitter in case anybody wants to reach out to you, follow you. And
first of all, thank you, Chirag, for this wonderful opportunity to talk about a favorite subject of mine. I hope made little sense at least. And on Twitter, I'm my ID is Pranasutra, Pranasutra. It'll be good to connect with some of the listeners of this talk, and hopefully we can discuss more.